I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, this is the month when we acknowledge the contributions of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders to the history and ongoing life of this country. We decided to observe it by speaking with people who have changed the game in their respective fields. Today, we are talking with Hikaru Nakamura. At the ripe old age of 24, he has already won the U.S. championships twice, and he is working on his third as we speak. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk more about President Obama's surprising, to some even shocking, announcement this week that he personally supports same-sex marriage. This after years of saying he could support civil unions but was not ready to embrace marriage equality. And what may have been equally surprising to some, the president cited his and the First Lady's religious beliefs as part of the reason he does now support gay marriage. Here is a clip from his interview with ABC's Robin Roberts.
We were both practicing Christians, and obviously this position may be considered to put us at odds with the views of others. But, you know, when we think about our faith, the thing at root that we think about is not only Christ sacrificing himself on our behalf, but it's also the golden rule.
Although he didn't come right out and say it, some of what is implied in the president's remarks is what analysts and observers have been buzzing about ever since, whether Mr. Obama's statement will turn off African Americans. And as a group, they count as both his strongest supporters and among the most skeptical voters when it comes to legalizing same-sex marriage. Their support has been crucial when the president has faced opposition and is expected to be so again in what is assumed will be a close contest this November. And as most people also know, faith leaders have always played a critical role in the political and intellectual life of Black America. For all these reasons, we decided to invite a panel of prominent African-American faith leaders to speak with us more about the president's statements. Joining us now are Bishop Harry Jackson. He's the senior pastor of Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland. He's been an outspoken opponent of same-sex marriage. And right now, he is one of those leading a petition drive to force the issue onto the ballot in Maryland this fall, where he hopes it will be defeated. Also with us, the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson. He is a professor at Georgetown University, the author of many books, and a sought-after commentator on political and social issues. Also with us, the Reverend Michael Waters. He is the founder and senior pastor of Joy Tabernacle AME Church in Dallas, Texas. I welcome you all to the program. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Very humble. Thank you for having us.
I'm going to start with you, Bishop Jackson, because as you said, you've been a very vocal opponent of same-sex marriage. I wanted to know what was your reaction when you heard President Obama's remarks?
Well, I really wasn't shocked because in Jeremiah Wright's congregation for 20 years, he has seen same-sex marriage committal services. So I think the president had this in his heart all along, but it was private. And the real issue then becomes why make it public now? So I and a couple of other folk, many other leaders, are really going to pull together some letters that just ask the president, would you explain to us, does this mean you're going to begin to let your personal opinions about this affect the Battle of Maryland, what you do? Last year, Al Sharpton, others, and some rumored the administration actually talked to people in Maryland about the same-sex marriage issue. So does it mean, hey, the gloves are off, I'm weighing in? Those are my real questions.
Well, you are a Democrat, although you are also a conservative, and sometimes
yes.
That does mean sort of straddling certain lines. I'm wondering how you're going to speak with your congregants about this. I mean, do you plan to talk with them about it?
Well,
I mean, I know you're not going to be proselyte. You're not going to be, giving political speeches from the pulpit. But I am interested. People do care about your views. So what are you going to say about
this? Yeah, this Sunday, actually, I'll make a statement asking the following question. What did the president mean? What are the implications? And then I want to say to our folks, we also want to find out what the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, Mitt Romney, what does he think? Because on his watch, even though he's been saying he's for traditional marriage, gay marriage was passed in the great state of Massachusetts. They got a lot of issues. So I think this is a moment for moral clarity. And if we have that, I will be happy. But I think right now a lot of people's heads are spinning and they're saying it's because of the money. It's because of the. But I think the president at his core simply is true to what he believes.
Reverend Dyson, a lot of people have been talking about whether the president's statement will turn off African-American voters. And you obviously speak to people in many venues about, you know, in many different contexts. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that many of them may be concerned, but I think once spoken to and once the issue is aired out, they'll be much more likely not to become obsessive about an issue that arguably should not be central to whether or not they determine that Mr. Obama deserves a second chance, a second term. I think that many African-American people certainly are conservative on this issue and certainly have a great deal of questions. But I think it's brave for the president to make his stance known. Bishop Jackson indicated it was his personal view, so he wasn't surprised, and I'm not either. But I think that, you know, we have to make a distinction between his personal views and what he holds in his faith view and its consequence on public policy.
Yeah.
He's already indicated that he respects religious traditions that make decisions predicated upon their views. So I think that you both can acknowledge that this is what he believes and then acknowledge that public policy won't change a great deal as a result of his views because, first of all, he's been for the equal rights of gay and lesbian, transgendered and bisexual people who form unions and forge connections so that they should be legally protected. This is more a question of faith and ethics and morality in relationship to same sexual orientation. And I think that black people certainly should be pushed on this as other Christians. And I think one of the great ironies here is that black people don't understand the parallel position of their own bigotry in regard to same-sexual couples and the issue of homosexuality more broadly, and white Christians who use the Bible and their religious traditions to make the argument that God was against black people's equality, black people being married to white people, or black people enjoying civil rights in America. So there are tremendous parallels here that we are loath to make, but that we ought to at least entertain.
We're speaking with a panel of prominent African-American faith leaders about President Obama's decision to come out publicly and say he personally supports same-sex marriage. I'm speaking with the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson. That's who was speaking just now. Bishop Harry Jackson, Jr. of Hope Christian Church in Maryland. And also with us, the Reverend Michael Waters, founder and senior pastor of Joy Tabernacle AME Church in Dallas, Texas. Reverend Waters, you know, in his remarks with Robin Roberts, the president said that he believes that many of the people who oppose same-sex marriage are not being mean with it, but that they believe that this somehow undermines marriage, and that's a particular concern in the African-American community. Is that where you are?
Personally, that is where I am. I do not find President Obama's stance on marriage to be same-sex marriage to be compatible with Christian teaching, tradition, and authority. And I think that particularly amongst the African-American community, church community, this is largely a shared belief and understanding. And so there is some concern, a relationship to those grounds and what the president has espoused. Nonetheless, I believe that Professor Dyson is quite right in suggesting that this might not turn away individuals from the president's reelection bid. I believe that it will galvanize some voters towards his cause, and surely it will turn other voters away. But I think that he, in large part, will still have a majority of the support of the African-American community, including those within the historic African-American church.
Well, what about you? What about you personally?
Personally, once again, his stance, I don't believe, bodes well with my understanding of Christian teaching, our understanding of Christian tradition and authority. But I do believe that, in my own personal opinion, that he is the best candidate for the position of the presidency. And in fact, while same-sex marriage is a moral issue, there are moral issues of greater concern for me as a voter in relationship to his candidacy and why I would vote for him again. I think that health care is a moral issue, and I think he's right on health care and therefore have my support. I think that educational opportunities for all persons is a moral issue, and therefore he has my support. And so on many issues, I find myself siding with the president. I do not support his stance on same-sex marriage, but nonetheless, I believe that he's right on enough moral questions whereby my vote for him is secure.
What about you, Bishop Jackson? I've never known whether you supported the president or not in his previous election. So what about you personally?
Well, I'll come out today right here on the radio. I have not supported President Obama. I was not a person pushing the other side. I was really challenged with his opponent last time. And I find myself in a quandary right now. I mean, we have a Mormon on one hand whose views on marriage and other things we need to clarify, in my view. And we have a president, though, that whose aggressiveness on this issue, and I call it aggressive, and the timing politically oriented, because he's had these views for 20 years. So I'm saying I probably cannot support the president. What will make a major difference in the election, but I may go into the voting box in a terrible quandary. My father suffered at the hand of whites in the civil rights movement, and I'm going to vote. But I don't know that box of president, what I'm going to put there. So that's my issue. But I believe that many, many people want to know what the president is going to do for real. And I think if the Republicans were smart, and some say they're two parties, party of corruption and a party of dumb, and sometimes Republicans, they don't get it. So if they were really wise, they would seize a moment, clarify their positions, talk to African Americans, but that way it could make a difference. If that's not done, no difference.
You know, Reverend Dyson, can I ask you about this? The Bishop Jackson raised a question about what he called the president's aggressiveness on this. I mean, there are those in the African-American community who are progressive who feel that he hasn't used his political and moral capital enough to articulate issues of particular concern to African-Americans, like the Troy Davis case, for example, who a man who was executed in Georgia. Many people feel wrongly, and the president didn't talk about that. And I just wondered if you feel that way as a black progressive yourself, if you don't mind my saying. And I am going to need to interrupt you, and I will come back to you after we take a short break, but if you would just tell, what do you think?
Sure. Well, I think that obviously there are a lot of things that the president could have done and that he should be encouraged to address. I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a both and. I think that this courage that he's displayed on marriage equality can be equally applied to issues of concern for African-American people and to make them American issues, not gay issues, not lesbian issues, not transgender or bisexual issues, not black issues, but American issues. High unemployment among black people should be addressed directly.
Well, Reverend Jackson, this is where I interrupt you, and we will come right back to you. We need to take a short break, and in a moment we'll continue this conversation with a group of African-American faith leaders about President Obama's support for gay marriage, his personal support for same-sex marriage. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. Reverend Dyson, I'll be right back with you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we will visit with Hikaru Nakamura at 24. He's America's top-ranked chess player. He's a game changer. We'll visit with him in just a few minutes. But first, we want to continue our conversation about how President Obama's stated support now of same-sex marriage is resonating in the African-American faith community. We are visiting with three prominent African-American leaders to talk about that. Bishop Harry Jackson Jr. Is the founder and leader of Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland. He's actually become a prominent national opponent of same-sex marriage. The Reverend Michael Waters is founder and senior pastor of Joy Tabernacle AME Church in Dallas, Texas. And the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson is a writer and commentator and a professor at Georgetown University. Reverend Dyson, if you would continue your thought, I was asking you about the views of some African-Americans that the president hasn't used enough of what they would like to see of his moral and political capital to articulate issues they think are of particular concern to African-Americans. That seems to be part of what is irritating some people here. Talk more about that.
Sure. As I was saying that, you know, there are many issues that the president could address that happen to disproportionately affect African-American people, but which are American problems. And I think that it's right for, you know, black progressive and liberal folk to want to use their energy and their encouragement of the president to inspire him to address these issues more directly and to take similarly courageous stands on issues that are critical to African-American people, while at the same time being mindful of the fact that there's a tremendous blowback. And let's be real here. The blowback that the president may get from his stance on gay marriage would not, perhaps will not be as intense as the blowback on him for speaking to issues of race. For instance, think about the Henry Louis Gates, you know, situation, the fiasco there in Cambridge when a white policeman arrested him in his own home and President Obama said that the police were acting stupidly. There was an enormous blowback. Even when he said Trayvon Martin would look like a son of his had he had one, there was tremendous blowback. And the kind of vicious animus and the kind of venom that's directed at him when he speaks about race has made him, some would say, understandably cautious about speaking about race, but courage is about addressing situations that, even though they may invoke or at least, provoke some kind of response, you really still have to take a stand. So I understand people who say that, and I don't think, again, it's an either-or. It's let's use this situation of speaking out on gay marriage to even encourage more speaking out on critical issues to our community.
Yeah, Reverend Waters, to that end, you know, we reached out on Facebook in advance of this conversation just to see what some of our listeners had to say about this. I want to read you part of a response from Sandra Howell in North Carolina, and she said, you know, this is the main reason why I don't attend churches who don't believe in the gay lifestyle. I don't want to, this is her words, not mine. She says, I don't want to be quote unquote undercover attending church services. However, that's how I feel when I enter other churches for various reasons. I attend a church that is, first of all, that will support as well as respect me for whomever I choose to love. And, you know, to this end, Reverend Waters, a lot of people say that the African-American church is kind of behind when it comes to acknowledging that people are here, they are part of the community and deserve the same level of respect. And they draw the analogy to the civil rights struggle. And you say to that, what?
Well, there is a crisis that is taking place currently within the African-American church, and that crisis is largely generational. You have those who are tremendously usually of the older generation that believe in the objective truths of Scripture, the universality of Scripture, and believe that those things that are contained there in the authority of the Bible is something to be abided by. Then you have a younger generation of particular individuals who would engage in social media to a large extent, this millennial generation that deals with a more postmodern view of the Bible and Scripture, where they reject objective truth, reject universality, and really in many ways abide to truths that are more subjective, that are based upon their experience and what they consider to be right rather than some absolute truth that moves beyond just their experience or their desires and speaks more to the truth revealed into time by God. And so that's an interesting crisis that is unfolding. And in fact, the African-American community, like young people today, what some people call the hip-hop generation, the hip-hop 2 generation, represent the most unchurched generations of African-Americans in American history. So it's not surprising that you would have these type of statements taking place. I actually think it's a great opportunity for the church to speak out on issues of this great concern and do so in a proactive way. I believe that where individuals are suggesting that the church is behind as it relates to its civil rights history and relates to the stance of the church today, I think you have to revisit that assessment of the church. As it relates to the civil rights movement was driven by a certain theology, understanding that God had created all persons in his image, and thereby on the basis of race, that all persons needed to be accepted and received in that regard.
Okay.
As it relates to maybe the matters of homosexuality, there's that question of whether it's a nature, whether you're born homosexual, whether it's a choice. That gets a little bit challenging as you engage in that discussion. Nonetheless, I still believe that the church stands to articulate or should articulate its stance on homosexuality with love for the individual, but likewise addressing concerns based on biblical truths.
All right, Reverend Waters, we have to leave it there. Reverend Jackson, I'm sorry I didn't leave you any time to say anything much except a very brief final word. I apologize.
Well, I want to hear more what the president is going to do with the bully pulpit and his power in light of this decision.
All right. Thank you. We'll leave it there for now. Bishop Harry Jackson Jr. leads the Congregation of Hope Christian Church. He's been part of the national effort to stop legal recognition of same-sex marriage, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. The Reverend Michael Waters is the pastor of Joy Tabernacle AME Church. He was with us from Dallas, Texas. And with us from New York, the Reverend Michael Eric Dyson, professor at Georgetown University. His latest book is Can You Hear Me Now? The Inspiration, Wisdom, and Insight of Michael Eric Dyson. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Very humble. Thank you so much.
And now we turn to game changers. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And all this month, we are talking to people who trace their heritage to that part of the world and who have made a difference in whatever field they happen to be in. Today, we are visiting with a game changer in the world of chess. The 2012 U.S. Chess Championships are taking place in St. Louis, Missouri this week and next. And the spotlight is on America's top-ranked player, Hikaru Nakamura. In 2003, at the age of 15, Nakamura became the youngest American chess grandmaster. In 2005, he became the youngest player to win the U.S. championships. He won it again in 2009. And at the age of 24, he's ranked number 7 in the world and closing in on Bobby Fischer's American record for most points earned from winning matches. He's also believed to have the best chance of any American to take the world's number 1 slot since Fischer did it 4 decades ago. And Hikaru Nakamura is with us now.
Thank you for having me here on the program. It's a pleasure.
And I think we should note that we are speaking to you in advance of the championships. I don't want people to think that you're skipping out on the championships to talk to us on your lunch hour. So just to establish that, do you mind if I ask how you are preparing? Is it a secret?
Not exactly, no. With chess, much of the focus on preparation deals with databases, in large part due to the internet advancements recently, where all the major games are played and broadcast on the internet, so therefore a lot of the players have access to all the games that their opponents are playing. And because of that, we're all sort of studying, looking at the opening phase, the first 5 to 10 moves of the game, and trying to find an advantage and find a little weakness or some sort of nuance where our opponent will feel a little bit uncomfortable and perhaps the pressure will make them do something that, you know, they normally wouldn't do, or they'll make some slightly inferior moves.
Can you remember now what drew you to it and why you were so determined to stick with it, even at that very young age?
Well, I think in large part, when I first began playing chess at 7 years old, I was quite bad at it. I lost a lot of games when I first started. In fact, the first time I ever played, I lost all 4 games. So it certainly wasn't an inauspicious start. But because I lost so many games when I first began, it sort of was a way of motivating myself to try and be better, because I hated losing. And so therefore, I just wanted to win more and more. And through that, I just kept slowly progressing. And eventually, I became a very strong chess player.
What does it take to be as good as you are? Do you think it's a gift that you have? Is it the preparation? Is it the tenacity? I mean, what is it that you think makes you great?
I think it's a combination. You have to have a certain natural ability and talent to become a very strong chess player. But at the same time, you also have to have a very strong mental will, the ability to get past losing games, to just move ahead and focus on the next game that's coming up. Because in many ways, it's very difficult, because during a tournament, if you lose a single game, it can really demoralize you. And so finding ways to get past that and focusing on the next round, the bigger picture of the whole tournament and trying to win, it's difficult. But I think it requires those two factors more than anything.
I understand that you have an aggressive playing style, which is what many of your fans love about you. But some in the chess world have referred to you as the John McEnroe of chess, and I don't think they mean it as a compliment. What are they talking about?
I think it's the fact that I'm a bit anti-establishment. I mean, when I lose games, I get annoyed. I'm certainly not always, you know, complimenting my opponents the way that a lot of chess players do. But
well, what do you do? Are you a club thrower like Tiger? What do you do?
No, I don't throw clubs. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, ultimately I try to intimidate my opponents. I try to scare them. You know, I try to be get any advantage, little edge that I can. So,
well, what do you do? Do you stare? Do you do a stare down like they used to do in boxing? Come on, give me some tips. If I have to intimidate my opponents, I want to know. I want some Nakamura tips.
Well, I think the main thing is that, you know, certain players, you know, I'll criticize their style. I'll say they're too passive. They'll take quick draws where each player gets half a point early on in the game instead of just fighting for 6 or 7 hours trying to crush their opponent to destroy them. And I will always try to do that. So there are a lot of little things that are that my style is different from most of the best players, because most of the players come from Europe. And in Europe, there's a different style to chess than there is in the United States.
Well, you know, what about that whole U.S.-Europe thing? I mean, when it comes to chess in the U.S., Bobby Fischer's shadow still looms large. And you, of course, know this because people are constantly hoping that you are kind of the great American and hope to regain it, the number one. Is that just a bit much? Do you wish people would stop saying that, or do you find it, you know, motivating perhaps?
It's a bit of both. I think in many ways what Bobby Fischer did for chess in America was great. He became the world champion. He raised the profile to levels which weren't seen before and haven't been seen since. So I think in some ways there's a lot of pressure to try and perform, but at the same time, I feel like it's inspiring because there are a lot of players still who were growing up during that era or who were adults at the time who still play chess. And so I feel like I have that chance, that opportunity to get to world champion, to raise a profile of chess. And ultimately, that's my goal. So it's a little bit of both in terms of the pressure versus the performance. But, you know, you can only play the game and try to perform at the highest level. And I feel at the moment I'm really doing a good job of playing at the very top. And hopefully I will get to world champion.
The U.S. Chess Championships are taking place this week. We're speaking with the top-ranked U.S. player, Hikaru Nakamura. And you know, the former world champion Garry Kasparov said about your win at last year's Tata Steel Tournament that your performance was perhaps better than any of Fischer's and perhaps the best by any American in the last century. Whoa. So do you agree? I don't know what to say to that. It's kind of a tough thing to sort of I'm inviting you to immodesty.
It was a great result, and I'm certainly very proud looking back on that tournament. But once again, my goal is to get to world champion. So even though I won that tournament and I've won some U.S. chess championships as well, getting to world champion, trying to reach those same levels that Bobby Fischer was at during the 70s and the Cold War, that's really, I mean, my ultimate goal. So it's going to be a fun ride. You know, I have a lot of years ahead of me, and we'll see what happens.
You are in the center of American chess. I mean, St. Louis made headlines when the entire chess team at Texas Tech transferred to Webster University in that city. You've made your home in that city. You know, the Scholastic Center and the World Chess Hall of Fame are located there. I understand that some of that has to do with the fact that there's a particularly interested financial donor there who has contributed greatly to that. But, you know, the most important tournaments are still in Europe. And you've said several times in our conversation that you'd like to raise the visibility of U.S. chess. You know, what difference do you think it would make to raise the visibility of U.S. chess? Why do you think that matters?
I think it matters because of what chess brings to the table in terms of the general skill set that it requires to play chess. It's been shown to improve the critical thinking skills as well as reading and writing. And in many ways, chess, I think, is a microcosm of the bigger picture where you play a game of chess and you try to make the best decisions. And when you look at life, I feel that it's much the same way where you try to evaluate the decisions, you try to make the best decisions. And so I think chess in many ways helps with that. And here in St. Louis, for instance, there are a lot of chess programs in many different schools in the greater St. Louis area. I think there are maybe around like 70 or 80 schools. And when you see what chess has beyond simply the professional level, what it can do for kids and for education, I think that that's the greatest benefit overall.
You've been described as a game changer by a number of people for a lot of reasons. And this is the month when we observe Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And we've been looking at people who are game changers. And I just wondered, whether does your ethnicity mean anything to you? Do you feel like you're, in a way, a role model and kind of showing people what's possible? Or does that just not come up in your world, which is such an international sport, I don't know, or game?
I wouldn't say it comes up that often because at the moment there aren't a lot of very strong Asian chess players. I mean, there's certainly some strong players from China, not so much from Japan, unfortunately, where I'm originally from. But there are a lot of kids who are playing chess now of Asian descent, and so they tend to look up to me. It's certainly an honor to have kids who are looking up to me, but at the same time, I'm just trying to do what I can to raise the profile of chess.
Who do you hope is looking at Hikaru Nakamura and being inspired?
I think, you know, or at least I hope it's the kids who are playing chess in schools who are thinking one day they can maybe become as good as I've become world champion, and really just to inspire the kids to take up the great game of chess.
What do you do when you're not playing chess?
I play quite a bit of tennis on the side. I'm into hiking and mountains, and I follow hockey and basketball pretty avidly.
Okay. Well, make us proud.
Thank you. I'll try my best.
Hikaru Nakamura is the number one ranked chess player in the U.S. He's playing this week in the U.S. Chess Championships in St. Louis, and we caught up with him there in advance. Hikaru Nakamura, thank you so much for speaking with us, and continued success to you.
Thank you.
Coming up earlier, we heard what a diverse panel of African-American faith leaders think about President Obama's announcement that he now supports same-sex marriage. But it's also a hot topic for the barbershop guys. Is this an historic victory for LGBT rights or just another tactical maneuver in an election year? Our guys weigh in. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we head into the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance journalist Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. In New York City, Kai Wright, the editorial director of ColorLines.com. Joining us here in Washington, D.C., R. Clark Cooper. He heads Log Cabin Republicans. That's an organization that works within the Republican Party to advocate for gays and lesbians. He's also an Army Reserve captain. And also here in D.C., Corey Dade, NPR digital news correspondent. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
What's up, man?
Hooah.
Wonderful.
Come on. What's going on?
Hooah. I don't know what else you need, but a hooah.
Okay, yeah. I guess I'll take it, right? Hooah.
Yeah.
All right. So,
all right, there you go.
Hey, let's get things started. You know, this week, President Obama became the first sitting American president to openly support gay marriage. Backers call it a historic moment. A civil rights victory for LGBT Americans, while critics say President Obama is inconsistent and this is political maneuvering. Guys, you know what? I want to know what you think of this. R. Clark Cooper, Coop,
hey.
Get the floor. You get the floor first. You're a conservative gay man who's been critical of Obama in the past and even on this issue and even about this announcement. Okay, why?
Well, let's start with the first things first. It was the right thing to say. So I want to make that clear. What the president said was the right thing to say. It is the position that has raised the bar on this discussion on the freedom to marry. So where the critique comes in is on the timing of the rollout. And some have called it, is it a distraction from the major issue of the economy? Also, was it a calculated rollout tied to money that was waiting in the wings that came forth this week in places like Hollywood? But the bottom line here is that it has raised the bar as far as marriage is concerned. And so the president's personal announcement to support the freedom to marry certainly has helped change the climate at a certain level. So the favorability.
Wait, can I just ask this? You must be in advanced yoga because the positions that you are twisting into here fascinate. This is your statement on this the day of the announcement that the president has chosen today when LGBT Americans are mourning the passage of Amendment 1. You're talking about it, North Carolina
yeah.
to ban same-sex marriage in the state constitution. You said to finally speak up for marriage equality is offensive and callous. That's what you said on the day of the announcement.
Mm.
And then your candidate, Mitt Romney, came out saying he doesn't even support civil unions.
And I'm not defending, by the way, I'm not defending Governor Romney on his position on this. So, you know, Log Cabin Republicans actively advocates for the freedom to marry. In fact, we work with that organization on Capitol Hill to repeal DOMA, which is the Defense of Marriage Act, which is the current federal statute out there that does not allow for same-sex recognition interstate-wide. So we're sharp on
but I guess what I'm asking is you're saying he's being cynical, but aren't you?
Am I being cynical?
Yeah,
no.
I mean,
this is we're probably being the most honest on this issue. We were probably one of the few of LGBT groups that said, "Hey, good, but hold on. Look at how this came." So if one looks back at where we were several days ago prior to the announcement, it wasn't just Log Cabin that was concerned about this. So like I said, good that he said it. Good on him. It's raised the bar on the issue, and we now have the most senior voice in the United States, and in many cases in the world. Having a head of government take such a position is helpful on the macro. But one does look if you look at the broader picture on the issues. Was this a shiny distraction?
Okay, well, I mean, okay. So that criticism doesn't hold water for me. So if he wasn't going to do it. You know, I mean, so if not now, when? I mean, what day would you have had him doing on? I mean, what? I mean, come on, that whole criticism is just
after Mitt Romney.
Nope. Yeah, well, right.
You're gonna have to ask Valerie Jarrett that question.
Guy Wright. Yeah. Guy Wright's written a lot about this. So you've written a lot about sexual orientation and politics. We've talked about it before. Guy, where are you on this?
The timing was perfect, I think, in terms of following the North Carolina vote to come out and make a moral stance. But I think actually two bigger things have gotten lost quickly in the sort of debate about the partisan politics of it. One is returning to a core principle here. One, the biggest enemy that gay and lesbian people have always faced is the shame and fear that keeps both us and our supporters in the closet. And what Obama did this week was stand up and say, listen, I'm coming out as believing that my gay friends' relationships have the same dignity as my own. And that's a really important historic thing. And the second thing that's gotten lost is, you know, as we've started to debate, well, how will African Americans react to this, is we're losing, and I think we saw this in North Carolina, we're losing the understanding that there's been a huge shift in the black community over the last 10 or 15 years that has mirrored the shift in America overall around not, again, not just same-sex marriage, but the rights and the dignity of gay people overall. And there have been a huge number of black faith leaders. In North Carolina, one of the most outspoken most aggressive spokespeople for gay relationships was the Reverend William Barber, who led the NAACP chapter there and was eloquent in his defense of the rights of gay and lesbian people. And so we're seeing a sea change, and the president standing up at I think is going to have a huge effect amongst African Americans who are debating the issue to say, oh, well, maybe I should think differently about this. And so
go ahead. Kai, you know, I've never given that trope of the you know, of the homophobic black American much of anything. I think what's happening in the black church is that the black church is getting younger. The younger the people are, you know, the minds are open. I mean we all got a gay homeboy. I mean, even your girlfriend might have a girlfriend. So no nobody's tripping about it anymore. It's not no big deal.
It's really right, Jimmy. It's really right.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like the older heads are still thumping that Bible and they're believing what their great grandmother's grandmother told them, but the young heads are getting down with Nicki Minaj and, you know, the whole bounce movement in New Orleans, you know, and even house music is coming back. So it's like no one's tripping.
That generational shift is applicable in the Republican Party. So the younger the Republican, the more supportive they are in gay rights.
Well, the other thing that always fascinates me is that people associate this issue with African Americans being African Americans, but is the issue among committed churchgoers with a conservative Christian stance.
Well, and Michelle, the polling supports that.
That's all it is.
Absolutely supports that.
Well, Corey's been checking on this. Corey Day, do you want to talk about it?
Sure, Michelle. I think what we're talking about is sort of a little bit of an overstatement of Black's opposition to gay marriage. I think Kai referenced it, but a Pew Research poll showed that Black opposition has dropped to 49% from 67% in 8 years. But the more significant thing is the biggest jump, the biggest decline has happened since 2008. So what's happened since 2008? They elected a Black president. The emergence of young voters who are more open to gay rights, the expansion of domestic partner benefits in the workplace, a modest increase in civil unions in certain jurisdictions, and then a weakening of the Christian conservative movement within the GOP. So all these things become this pot that stirs and influences opinion. As far as African Americans are concerned, the bigger question is whether or not Obama's position now changes the discourse among Black families that still are not en masse embracing their homosexual family members.
But why wouldn't it in the same
way?
But why wouldn't it in the same way that when George W. Bush, as president, stood up and went to a mosque in the wake of 9/11 and said, these people are not our enemy. Terrorism is our enemy, not Islam. And that had an effect on the opinion of white evangelical Christians among whom he was a thought leader. Why wouldn't it have the same effect among African Americans?
Well, I think I'll point you to something I wrote yesterday. There's a study that a political scientist did in Chicago. They took, it was essentially a phone banking sort of poll experiment where they had callers call Black people and ask them to support gay marriage. The callers who were Black got much more of a positive response from the respondents because it was one of one of their own community asking them to change their mind about an issue. So it could really happen with Obama stepping forward.
Finally, Carr, can I just ask you finally, do you think, though, that this might have the equal effect of galvanizing support among white conservative Christians who are not in love with Obama anyway, and galvanizing support around Mitt Romney, to whom they have been lukewarm?
That is yet to remain to be seen. In fact, that's something all GOP strategists are looking at right now. What it has done is it has defined or will determine definition within the GOP on where Republican lawmakers and policymakers lie. So, you know, this includes fellow GOP strategist Steve Schmidt. He and I have talked about this. John Weaver is that we're at the point now where we are at a crossroads in the GOP where people are either going to stand up for some sort of legal recognition of same-sex couples, be it civil unions like Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, or full marriage equality like Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee Ilhan Roslagen, or what we've seen now where Governor Romney's come out in a position of opposition. And people are going to have to pick a side, and the chips will fall where they fall, and that will be determined by the electorate as well as voting Republicans. But this is the lines are being defined right now.
We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with R. Clark Cooper of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's who was talking just now. Kai Wright of ColorLines.com is with us from New York. Corey Date is our NPR digital correspondent. And, of course, Jimmy Israel is with us. Back to you, Jimmy.
Oh, back to me. All right.
Well,
I'm
you know what? Actually,
that.
I'm sorry. I know you wanted to talk about Jimmy. I know you wanted to talk about this article in the Post that ran right. This a front page piece about, speaking of GOP presumptive nominee Mitt Romney, saying that he actually led an attack on a fellow student when he was in prep school, where he helped pin the kid down and cut off his hair because the kid had dyed his hair blonde. And Mitt Romney said he doesn't remember the incident, but we'll just play a short clip. He talked to Fox News about this. Here it is.
I certainly don't believe that I, or I can't speak for other people, of course, but thought the fellow was homosexual. That was the furthest thing from our minds back in the 1960s.
But, Jimmy, you know, you've talked a lot about the things that you think should be on bounds and out of bounds. But the Post made the argument that, you know, that his supporters, Mitt Romney's supporters, have cited his teenage years to sort of say what a sense of humor he has, and he's not the stiff that he appears. So in that context, do you think it's fair? Do you think it's fair or not?
I do not think it's fair. I think it's biting him both ways, but I don't think it's fair. None of us are fully formed people as teenagers. You know, I'm not convinced you can glean anything about the feelings of an adult from the actions of a child. I'm not saying. I mean, what do you say? You know, I mean, it's not like he was setting cats on fire. You know, which is like, you know, I mean, that's psychotic. I mean,
was psychotic too.
Yeah,
I was going to say.
Go ahead.
This is certainly
psychotic, but you're
presuming it did occur because the family members of the alleged victim and classmates have come out later this week saying that this story's bunk. So as we say in military intelligence, verify, which is supposedly the rule of journalism.
But they
as
also
well.
Reported that some of these gentlemen who came forward who say they were part of this incident say that they were so troubled by it that even as adults they felt a need to apologize to this gentleman. And these people are on the record. So I don't know. I wasn't there.
And now this family's putting out a statement today.
Okay. Well, but actually I think, again, so
you know,
there's
so
a
anyway,
issue.
Just to tie a bow on a Clark, you don't buy it. You just don't buy it. You just don't think it happened.
I just say that all the data points aren't in, and that's why I said this. I think there was a leaping before looking on publication at this point. So, you know, but I think the jury's out on this. And frankly, I go back to the earlier point is that, look, teenagers are teenagers, and, you know, I mean, do I need to declare on here, or maybe I should? You know, I played mailbox baseball, and if you don't know what that is, you didn't grow up in a rural area. Yeah, right?
No, I didn't.
So, you know, I mean,
you got me on
is
that,
that
one,
the same
brother.
As, like, Halloween right. trick-or-treating on your elevator line?
No.
No,
not
sorry.
At all. No.
Never mind. Okay, fine.
Yeah, well,
Kai, why don't you tie a bow on it? You think it
but
is
you know
fair.
What? None of the – no, actually, I agree with Jimmy that, you know, what happened in high school was a long time ago, and whether it did or did not happen, you know – It was a long time ago. The question for Governor Romney is how is he as an adult on respecting people who don't look like him and act like him? And, you know, and I think, again, there's a larger issue here that's actually revealed in Mitt Romney's comment about it. And, you know, and he said, well, we certainly weren't thinking if we did that kind of thing, we certainly weren't thinking about his sexuality. And I think this is really important because we see today in the bullying that we have with such a problem that we now know has been going on since 1965, the issue is perceived. The issue is that people who look different, who are perceived to be gay, who are perceived to be transgender, who are perceived to be something, get violently bullied. And it's a big deal, and it remains a big deal today, you know. And so whatever we think about whether Mitt Romney did it or not, I hope that it's another reminder of the fact that this isn't the same as mailbox baseball. This isn't just teenagers being teenagers. It's a big deal when kids get bullied.
Well, let me just point out that just the family member said, who the surviving family member, the gentleman who was the victim of this attack, passed away. The family member issued a statement saying she did not hear this from her brother. So not that it never happened, but that her brother never told her about this. And I don't know.
So there was no rosebud.
I don't know. I had a brother too, and he didn't tell me everything that happened to him in his life. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know. I will say though that if you don't mind my saying that as a person who attended boarding school and was later on the board of one, I mean, there has been a sea change in attitude about hazing of any stripe directed at any person. I mean, it was common back in the day, and it was never thought of as a problem. And the attitude about it has changed, 360 degrees since that time about the kind of behavior that was tolerated among peers. And that doesn't justify it. I'm just saying that, it's so hard to say. The kind of behavior that people thought was normal back then is just not at all acceptable today, that adults turned a blind eye to. That's all
I said earlier,
my personal experience.
I mean, as Kai said earlier, looking at where we are now, it's to say that bullying is not acceptable. And this is why you have across the board, including great conservatives like Governor Huckabee, have on his show talk about the issue of bullying. So this is something that has been brought forward as far as what is unacceptable. It's a no-go zone.
Corey, I'll give you the final word, and it's just your digital media guy. Is this hot on the block? Is this story hot on the block or not?
It is hot. Anything involving Mitt Romney is going to be hot. Anything that would sort of suggest that he was homophobic or that he gay-bashed is going to be hot. The question is whether or not it has any legs, and it probably doesn't beyond the moment.
Jimmy, does it have legs or not?
Nah. Jimmy? Nope. None.
Well, we know not with you.
there's no there. There's no there there. I mean, he might have egged his neighbors too. I mean, I don't know. There's just no there there.
Kai, there there or no there?
It's a bad week for Romney for this to come out, but in the end, this election is going to be about the economy, not any of this stuff.
Kai Wright is editorial director at ColorLines.com. That's a daily news site covering race, politics, and culture. He was with us from our bureau in New York. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University, with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Corey Dade is a correspondent for NPR's Digital News. He was here in Washington, D.C., along with R. Clark Cooper, the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a group that advocates for gays and lesbians and their issues within the Republican Party. He's a captain in the Army Reserve as well. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, yep.
Hoa.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.